I am Joanne Hepworth, and I am a grateful and happy religious science practitioner. And I have begun a journey towards a professional practitioner's practice and hopefully a study group out in West Virginia. And I'm very excited about it. My house in Bethesda is under contract.
Yay.
For 3 days now. Uh-huh. So I need prayer for that. When we get to the prayer list, please pray for me that this home inspection goes well and this rock is removed. So that was a very appropriate song for me. And I had a very interesting experience with this exercise. Connie asked me about a month ago or so, maybe 6 weeks, to share, teach this, or discuss, lead this discussion on these two chapters. And did everyone read them? Did anybody read them? Okay. All right. They're very interesting, but most interesting was when I first undertook it, I got the book and I was, you know, reading the book and reading the introduction and stuff, and I didn't really look at the chapters I was supposed to read. And then when I looked at the chapters I was supposed to do, it was, the titles are How to Enjoy Abundant Health for Creative Living, 1, and How to Enjoy an Abundant Health for Creative Living, 2. And as a practitioner, I have always been very hesitant about dealing with health issues with people, physical health issues particularly. And of course, the word health to me instantly said physical health, and instantly said, oh my God, I can't do that. Anyway, but then I realized that this was, of course, a very important step for me and something I really needed to get addressed and get over. And in reading the introduction to this book is called The Ideas of Power, and it's Ernest Holmes Papers, Volume 3. And it's compiled by a man by the name of...
George Bender,
yes.
It's on the cover.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, George Bender, yes. Okay. But anyway, he's written an introduction to the book, which is quite interesting and quite illuminating about sort of the history of the time. And what I realized with this lecture, these papers are part of a lecture series that were done in the 1950s. And the first thing on the book is that following World War II, the people of the free world were seeking, I better get my glasses, were seeking a, sorry, were seeking a living, loving God of hope and freedom. In this period and through the 60s, the rise of healing religion was responsible for a golden age of belief, and the central theme seemed to be, prepare us to live today, not to die tomorrow. And those words really spoke to me. It really spoke to me about several things. First of all, in the 1950s, my mother was very ill, and one of the seminal aspects that had driven my life and most of my learning was my mother's death when I was 5. And that was in 1954. And I recently came across some letters that my father had written to his sister concerning my mother's illness. And it was struck me how deeply religious and spiritual his writings were. I mean, he was telling his sister that my mother was going to die, and that he had just been told this, and that he had to tell her. And his
he was a, they were Catholics, strong Catholics, and he was extremely spiritual. Like this happened. Yeah, I learned this on the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, and this must be God's way of telling me that, you know, that he wants a substitute for his mother or whatever. I mean, it was very religious, which I did not know my father to be, at least later on in his life. Not deeply religious anyway. And this, the idea that this took place, that the connection between the 50s, the post-war, and this movement sort of helped me understand a lot of that and how that worked in my life. And the other thing that struck me was that during that period of time, I often pleaded with God to bring my mother back. And I felt that I had failed, and that failure has been driving my inability to just deal with people's illness, or in terms of my practice, I felt that I just wasn't capable of that. So those two things were very, very dear to me and important, and I was happy to deal with them during this time. So with that background, and also there's a number of other things in the introduction here, which I highly commend this book, this reading. It is a little bit, the language and some of the sentiments are a little bit dated, obviously, and they're somewhat difficult to accept during, like some of the ways that they talk about this, especially this Dr. Fink. The first chapter is by Dr. Fink, who is a medical doctor and a metaphysician, and he gives a talk about abundant health for creative living from sort of a medical standpoint, and his story, several of his stories are about how women and how their husbands want them to be their mothers more than their friends or more anyway. So, and they should adapt. They should become what their husbands want if they want a happy marriage and all this stuff. Yeah. So, well. So that was a little icky, but but then Ernest Holmes wrote the next chapter. But actually his thesis is quite familiar and stated in unfamiliar language, but it is quite familiar in that he has basically his answer to all illness that he confronts is that attitude is everything, and of course that's true. Mind body connection is something that we are very familiar with at this in this stage, but from his point of view, it's attitudes from a moral character point of view, and not, well, maybe I shouldn't use the word moral, but from a character. I don't know if he uses the word moral character or not, but what he's talking about is the that you need to. I'll give you an example. He's his. If people who suffer depression, that's not a good example. People who are alcoholic are addicted to alcohol for a reason, and that alcohol is a pleasure, and that instead of, and the alcohol is usually an escape and a pleasure, and in order to get around that, they need to devote themselves to their creative life and not indulge in alcohol, and be just get on with it, because mostly everybody's desire is to fulfill their divine destination, and these segues are just ways of avoiding it, and they become necessary because you're avoiding it, which is basically true, but it's a little hard to get to get around this. I'll read you a couple of passages that are very interesting, actually. An attitude is the way you are. Sorry. The way you are prepared to act in any situation. You must seek creative living, and you can have abundant health for creative living if you make creative living your goal. That is what I want to talk about. Just keep your mind on wanting to accomplish something worthwhile. Trust in the infinite love of God. Okay, now this is his basic thesis. There are 5 steps to abundant health in creative living. The first one is the goal. The goal represents your visualization of the situation that will satisfy your need. Whatever your goal is, you visualize that. That's number one. Number two, you must visualize yourself as the kind of person who has the character traits that make for the kind of success you want. Goal first, vision second. Number three is repetition. Constantly keep in mind the goal and the vision. The fourth you might not like. The fourth step is sacrifice. Now this is the one that's kind of interesting. And as he suggested, I didn't like sacrifice. But what he was talking about was not so much like penance or that kind of thing, but it's sacrifice in that you have to give up that which is standing between you and your creative life, and that's your sacrifice. So if it's alcohol, it's alcohol. If it's eating, it's eating. If it's sleeping too much, or if it's depression, or if it's I think he's also believes that illness can in some cases be a way of avoiding your creative living. So you have to give up what you don't want and really don't care about in order to get what you do want and you do care about, which I found a lot more acceptable after I understood it. But, and then he says, this is sort of a summary. I've told you how to achieve abundant health for creative living and organized it for you. Perhaps you can pass that on to someone. By changing their character traits to achieve the things they want to achieve, you can do it by having a definite goal, by seeing themselves as the kind of person who deserves to achieve that goal, by repeating the goal constantly in prayer, 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 and by sacrifice of everything that is not essential to achievement of the goal, and by having faith in results. And then he said, now Ernest Holmes said he's going to talk right away, so I'm going to give you a break. But, so, I mean, stated that way, it's really more or less everything we teach, really, is knowing that you know, seeing your vision and moving towards it, and making yourself ready to achieve it, and giving up what doesn't serve it, and then having faith that it'll come through. So, in that sense, he's on point, but is a little bit sexist in his in his thinking. But you know, not unlike everybody else at that time, you know, which is a good reminder of how far we've come, you know.
I like that.
But then, chapter 5 is Ernest Holmes, who sort of refers to this talk, but doesn't really embrace it the way he did in terms of health for creative living. But it's a very interesting chapter. I'll read this passage too. First, there is first of these is that we are living in a spiritual universe now, in which an infinite intelligence eternally lives, equally distributed through the time and space, impersonal to everyone, until it is personalized in and through that person, and that of necessity there is a there are prototypes, archetypes, or ideas of spiritual patterns in the invisible for everything that is visible, and that naturally we are tied to this pattern. So what I got from this chapter and what for, I mean, first of all, it's a different way of seeing Ernest Holmes' teaching. Mm-hmm. It's stated differently, and it struck me as, it helped me understand more deeply the underpinnings of our philosophy and our teaching. It helped me to understand where he's coming from. He talked a lot about the organized religions of the day. And there's one quote in here that I really, really like. He said something, God is not a white-haired man with thunderbolts coming out for the Baptists and sort of, what did he say, benefits coming out for the Methodists. his really disdain for that whole types of religion, that vision of God. He says that there's so much evil that comes from the misrepresentation of God in this way, or the misinterpretation of God in this way. This is a lot about what this chapter is about. Is more about the dangers of that, of the belief systems that are prevalent of the day, and how his belief system and religious science was the way to go, more or less. And so his points too were very helpful. He said that one of the things that he was also railing on about self-righteous people and their indignation, and I think this is a very funny piece here. He said, as Emerson said, when virtue is self-conscious, it is vicious. Just try and spend the whole day with someone who knows he's good. Yeah. If you've never thought of murder before, you will contemplate it before the night. and he was in that he was talking about the story of Job, and how Job's, and I've always never understood the story of Job, but basically his explanation is that he just pissed God off because he was kept telling God how righteous he was, and God just said, you know, you were so righteous, where were you when I created the earth and everything? I didn't see you there. And then he put him through his paces, I guess. So that was good too. And another point that came out that was very important to me is that freedom, we have free will, but we have free will within the limits of the law. And as long as we are in the flow of the natural order of things, then we are good. But if we resist it, when we start to resist it, is when things go awry, and that's when we have problems and we have disconnect. And those that bondage that we create when we resist is a result of our freedom. And if we didn't have the freedom, we might not have the bondage. And if we didn't have the bondage, we wouldn't have the freedom. So it's part of the privilege to have these episodes of difficulty that create problems. Dr. Fink made the point that we are free to create a happy life or create a miserable life, and that freedom is all part of who, as human beings, what we get to do. And but we can choose to create that happy life, and his thesis is through living creatively and fulfilling our destiny, whatever that may be. And and I found it interesting that Ernest Holmes talked about the Maya, which is the illusion, which is talked about in the Hindu or in the Advaita Vedanta philosophy. And it's always been so interesting to me that that there's so many parallels between. When I first came to religious science, I came from an Advaita Vedanta tradition, and was looking for a more Americanized version of that teaching, and that's what religious science was to me. And it has proven to be consistent with all of the things that I was taught in Kriya Yoga, and just with a more culturally attractive format for me. And the idea of Maya in the Gita was very difficult for me to understand, although I ultimately think I did get it. But this way that Ernest described it, which I'll read to you. And so we have freedom to go with the tide of cosmic affairs or resist it. And in doing it, project our reaction in the universe of reality until to us it becomes, as some of the ancients called it, Maya, the world of illusion. It isn't exactly illusion, it's delusion. It's not a thing in itself, and I discovered after all these years... Oh, that's different. That's not something else, but that's what I was interested in that explanation of Maya. Here's a good passage too. Our theology says the kingdom of God is at hand, and that we shall never know any God outside the confines of that thing only which can know anything, in the confines of that only thing which can know anything, whether you call it your consciousness, or your mind, or your awareness. And I don't know who Angela Morgan was. Does anybody know who Angela Morgan was? Okay. He quotes her here saying that inner self that never tires, fed by the deep eternal fires, angel and guardian of the gate, master of death, king of fate. And here he's talking about being awake, you know, and he really describes it as just knowing the presence, which I have really been working with lately. Just as I live in a beautiful area with a, you know, just beautiful surroundings, and I frequently go out into the woods and just feel feel the presence and feel, you know, in the river or in the dog, you know, in whatever natural thing is there. And it becomes so obvious to me, the awareness, the deep truth of what we believe, even though I'm frequently filled with doubt. And frequently I'm like, well, maybe, you know, but you know, there is no question when I am in touch with what Ernest calls that inner self that is never touched by any harm, any doubt, any nothing, and where we perceive accurately our destiny, really. And so, I mean, that way it's presented here is somewhat different than the way it's been presented before. And always when I read something that I understand different from a different perspective and I read it somewhere else, it gives me a new insight and a new feeling of just the truth of it. So, I mean, I really enjoyed that with this reading. And Ernest often goes into great lengths at arguments. He makes an argument, and often I find his argument a little bit contrived. I mean, a little bit. You have to say, well, maybe that's. I mean, your premises may be correct, but they also may not be. But it doesn't matter because ultimately he gets to the truth and I don't really need those arguments. I mean, I'm willing to accept it on faith, but the arguments don't necessarily persuade me. I think in this book he's talking about, well, you didn't create the world, you didn't create yourself, you didn't create this and you didn't create that, and therefore it must be God, you know, or that kind of, I mean, I think he alternates between God and the power for good, and I mean, you don't have to call it God. I mean, you can call it anything, but, and therefore something. And I think that that's true. I mean, I think that's part of when I come to doubt, I have to look at the world and how much beauty and grace and power there is that nobody is doing. I mean, it's not a city, it's not a government, it's not anything that we can point at that's creating this. Now, my scientist friends think that, you know, believe that they have the explanation to it all, and maybe they do, but I don't know it. And I don't see any explanation for the order of the universe and the beauty of nature and all the abundance that there is. I just see that that it's definitely a power for good that is out there, and when applied correctly, you can use it. Mm-hmm. And like that. So anyway, so in the conclusion of this chapter that I read, these chapters that I read, I'll just read you the sort of conclusion. I think that the beginning of wisdom is not the fear of God, but the knowledge, the love, and the worship, and the adoration, and the sense of a divine presence. As Emerson said, how wonderful is the thought of God peopling the lovely places with his presence. And we do spend much time seeking that thing within us which is beyond fear, beyond isolation, beyond separation, and beyond good and evil, beyond that theology, what theology teaches, that simplicity, that childlikeness which is not childish but childlike. There's no living soul can do for you nor for me. No living soul can do for you or do for me. But hid deep within the soul, hid deep within the silence, hid in the beauty of nature is that which speaks. There is a testimony of the soul, there is an inward awareness, that which you shall discover, and then you shall meet God in yourself. Mm-hmm. And so that is basically my presentation on this subject, and I would love to hear what you all have to say about this or anything else.
Thank you, Joanne. Thank you. Yay.